Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. The state's newest ski resort is for the mega-rich only. Moms who are former members of the polygamous fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints say their kids have gone missing since Warren Jeff's latest revelation from prison, and an audit alleges former Cache County prosecutors misused public resources. Joining me today on the program are Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're joined also by reporter Courtney Tanner. Thanks, Courtney.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. State Watch reporter Jacob Scholl joins us. Thank you.
Morning, Tom.
And news columnist Robert Gerke will be providing commentary throughout. Robert, thank you.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. You can join this live conversation by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Let's begin with Brian Maffley. The headline is Utah's newest ski resort is for the mega-rich only. Brian, tell us where this is being built.
Sure, Tom. Yeah, it's kind of a provocative headline. But the place is known as Wasatch Peaks Ranch. And it's probably one of the largest blocks of private land in Utah. And it's in Morgan County. It's pretty much the most of the east side of the Wasatch Mountains, roughly from Weber Canyon south to Francis Peak and then some, maybe 11 miles. And it's a vast area. And some pieces of it actually go over the ridge line into Davis County. But this resort is in Morgan County, and it was rezoned a few years ago to accommodate this plan for a private ski area. By the way, it's a lot more than a ski area. That's the ski area is just its kind of central amenity, and it's going to have five lifts. Three are already running this winter, so they had a full ski season. And they're constructing a championship golf course. There'll be a village, miles and miles of trails. And it's been approved for 750 housing units. So the only people who get to use these world-class amenities are the residents and their guests. So, not a ton of people. And it's being marketed to, the most wealthy people in the world. So we decided belatedly, the Tribune has kind of started taking a hard look at this project, which has, it's pretty much divided the community in Morgan County, which is still pretty, agricultural, even though it's really right next to Ogden, maybe, 15 miles up Highway 84. And it still has, it's growing pretty quickly right now, but it still has that, bucolic charm of these valleys here, tucked in behind the Wasatch Mountains. It really is gorgeous. And these mountains that have now become the ski area of Wasatch Peaks Ranch, it's really great ski terrain. It's a little low in elevation. It tops out at about 9,500 feet, but these mountains are spectacular. And, most of us listening to this program today will never have an opportunity to ski it.
So how rich do you have to be? What are they charging to get in to get a piece of this?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're not totally certain about that. We're having to piece a lot of stuff together from what is in the public domain. So the company involved is called Wasatch Peaks Ranch LLC. They are owned by, we think, 10 investors who acquired the property in 2019 from Dick Bass and Earl Holdings Estates. Those guys' families had owned the property for about 20 years prior. It's an old ranch, and we believe from the filings they've submitted to the Securities and Exchange Commission that memberships initiation fees are going to be $500,000, and they have 94 people signed up as of December. But we did do an interview with the managing partner for the company. His name's Ed Schultz. He was great, actually. He wouldn't go into the money stuff because it was proprietary. He wanted to protect the privacy of the owners, so he's not, they're not divulging who they are. And nor will they, you know, allow us in to do a tour and just check out the facilities. So, but he did sit down with us and talk about what the vision is for the resort and all the positive things that they think it will bring Morgan County. Needless to say, there are a lot of people in Morgan County have a much different take on it.
Yeah, what are the concerns?
Well, the concerns are it's going to change the county in pretty fundamental ways, in terms of having an area so large that is not available to the public at large, but also is being built up. However, it's one thing you need to point out here is that other proposals for that land, envisioned a much bigger footprint, thousands of homes with a public ski area. That has been a vision for that property for many years, since Earl Holding bought the property back in the late 90s from the Gailies, who ranched it for many years before that. So it seems like it's something was going to happen on that land, whether it was a place for the ultra wealthy or for just regular folks. Things were going to change there. There is a group of residents in Morgan who have gone to court and their case is in trial right now to force the county to hold a voter referendum, asking the voters whether they want to have the rezone on that property rescinded, which would in effect strip the entitlements off that property to develop this resort. So Judge Hyde is hearing that today as we speak, and then there's other lawsuits as well. I don't know if we have time to get into them, but anyway, people are deeply concerned about how having a project of this magnitude may affect their community. What I think they're really worried about is sleepy Morgan County becoming like Park City or Heber City.
Yeah, that's the example that they use, and they're not using it in a positive way, right? They don't want to turn into Park City or Heber City.
Exactly. From my perspective as a journalist who's been in the state for almost 30 years now, watching it change so profoundly in those years, it seems like that trend toward getting becoming like Wasatch County or Summit County is already underway and may be unavoidable. You think about it, Morgan County is situated in the exact same way Wasatch County is situated in relationship to Utah County. And then Morgan County is situated right next to Davis and Weber counties, which are growing like crazy. And for the most part, Morgan County has become a bedroom community to, the Ogden area, for folks who work in the Ogden area and Hill Air Force Base and things. But it still is a beautiful place. Every time I go through there, I'm going, geez, this is really a really pretty slice of Utah that hasn't been wrecked yet.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very beautiful. Yeah. So the positives of this development that people are touting is increased tax revenue and potential jobs, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. So the proponents of the resort, they commissioned a tax impact study, and its projections are incredible. They're talking about a net increase of property tax revenue to the county of $9 million a year when it reaches build out. And their definition of build out is only 475 homes, not 750, which is allowed under their permit. And then another $25 million a year to the school district. That's like triple what those entities were collecting in 2019 when this thing got approved. So then the job wise, they're projecting it's going to support at least 600 jobs, maybe it's like 400 and change directly at the resort, folks who work there, running the golf course or as fishing guides or ski patrollers or taking care of the homes. And then another 130 odd jobs offsite. So it would become a pretty large employer. Ed Schultz, the managing partner, told me they already have 130 seasonal jobs, making them one of, he thought, maybe the fifth largest employer in Morgan County already, and it's there isn't a single home completed yet. So it will have this kind of quote unquote positive fiscal impact on the county. The critics of the project say, look, we need to be thinking more in terms of money. We need to be thinking about what we want to be as a community.
Just one more thing on this story. Then I want to get to a story just published this morning
Sure.
on landslides. But this is apparently part of a trend here in the West.
Exactly. And we've gotten so many just really thoughtful comments to our reporting so far, and a lot of our commenters have told us about a scholar named Justin Farrell, who's from Jackson. He wrote a book a couple years ago called Billionaire Wilderness. And Grant Birmingham and I started reading it yesterday. We were so intrigued, and I think it's worth reading. But Justin, who is actually, believe it or not, is a sociologist at Yale University of all places. I think he belongs out here. In his book, he just talks about how this trend has really proliferated across the West, and it was really turbocharged during the pandemic, where incredibly wealthy people from the coasts and maybe abroad have come to look to the West as a place to build their dream homes and acquire vast these kind of these vast blocks of property, private property that have not been developed. And Utah, northern Utah especially, has a lot of that available. But we're also talking to Montana and Jack and sorry, Wyoming and Idaho as well. And that's one of the reasons why Grant and I decided that we needed to tackle this. I think we're going to see this is becoming an increasing trend. It probably started in Summit County, but now seems to be spreading all across northern Utah from the West, these northern counties in Weber, Cache, Morgan, Salt Lake, Summit. So anyway, this will be something that we're going to be covering more aggressively going forward.
Well, we'll look for that reporting. If you just joined us, you're listening to Behind the Headlines. We're talking right now with Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. I want to talk briefly about your story just published today on the threat of landslides. I want to start with this interesting fact in your story. Even though Utah is a very dry state, we have a lot of landslides. That's one of the geologists that you were talking to.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, that was from Rich Gerow, who retired from the Utah Geological Survey a couple years ago. He was giving a presentation of the USGS, and what he was talking about was this: that Utah has a lot of the topography that lends itself to landslides. It's steep, and the soils are unconsolidated in places. And it's yeah, of course Utah is a dry state. However, we get a lot of snow in the mountains, even on a dry year, frankly. And when that snow melts, or when we have really heavy monsoonal rains, the grounds get highly saturated and things start moving. And what makes this year so unique and so concerning is we have the biggest snowpack on record, probably double what it is on a quote unquote normal year. I think the idea of normal is gone out the window these days. So it does seem kind of ironic that we're a dry state, but we have a lot of ground movement. And what's become a problem in the last 50 years is how much residential development has occurred in these dangerous areas, in the Was namely the Wasatch Foothills for the most part. But also other areas. But where we're seeing the worst, potential for impacts is along the Wasatch Front. And so it was, 40 years ago to the day, practically, that last time we had an epic snowpack, 1983, was Utah's most destructive landslide. It just, resulted in the destruction of the town of Thistle. and caused hundreds of millions of dollars of damage because it buried the railroad through Spanish Fork Canyon, U.S. Highway 6, and then of course it blocked a river, and the river backed up and created a reservoir over what was then the town of Thistle. So, you know, no one got hurt. The landslide was a slow moving thing, you know, maybe a couple miles an hour at its peak. But it did, was extremely disruptive. It's in, you know, of course, and it occurred at a point that we are facing today, with the melting of a record-setting snowpack. So the question is the snowpack going to melt rapidly or gradually over the next 2 months? And I think I love it if Jacob could speak to this. He's been writing a lot about what are the best case and worst case scenarios for the melting of the snowpack. Do you want to jump in here for a sec, Jacob?
Yeah, Jacob, but your story was about how do we get the snowpack down safely, right? Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so really the best case scenario is, like what Brian said, it's really just going to be slowly easing snowpack off the mountains with, pretty average temperatures for springtime. Brian referred to the very sudden runoff that happened in 1983, and that essentially was just because the temperatures went from fairly cool, kind of normal temperatures, and all of a sudden over Memorial Day weekend in 1983, the temperatures jumped up into the 80s and 90s, which really caused that snowpack to run off all at once. So just depending on where you are, kind of in northern Utah, it really just comes down to what the temperatures are, how quickly that snow is going to run off. And according to all the water managers and emergency officials that I've talked to, really the best case scenario is just to have temperatures fairly well in line with spring averages and, hope that Mother Nature doesn't throw a 90 degree day at us out of nowhere.
Yeah. Well Jacob, been out in the mountains a lot the last couple of weeks, and there is so much snow left in the mountains, and it seems kind of ominous this late in the spring to have so much snow left. And is it good that we're having such a cool spring, or is because it seems like it's slowing it's delaying the runoff period to deep into May and possibly June, and that's when we get those 90 degree days.
Yeah, so I guess it kind of varies by area. So, for example, Cache Valley, I was talking to a water manager up, in the Cache Water District, and he was saying that the temperatures in Cache County have been colder than normal, essentially, for spring. So that's the kind of weather that is going to be potentially problematic farther down the line, because the longer that the snow stays in the mountains and the closer we get to the end of May and June, I agree that's when it's going to potentially cause issues. If you have temperatures that are fairly close to the averages for spring, that's gonna be the temperature that's more in line with the whole potential to slowly have that kind of runoff come off the mountains. It's a game of margins. So it's really just going to depend on the weather.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to finish up just about the landslide, just to say that the Utah Geological Survey has already identified several spots where there's earth movement that's threatening people's private property. And they detailed them. They started a new webpage on their website. It's geology.utah.gov. Go there, and they'll have a page prominently displayed, have it with information about ongoing slides. So there's some activity in Immigration Canyon, City Creek Canyon, Fruit Heights, Layton, and Mountain Green. Those are five spots that are already showing signs of movement that people ought to be aware of.
Well, I'll just mention this. We're out of time for this segment, but in your story, one of your experts says we could expect new slides and old ones could be reactivated. That's not very reassuring. So, so Brian Maffley is public lands and environment reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke, so we had a lot there. So maybe start with your commentary on that ski resort for the mega rich.
Yeah, where to begin? This on some level, sort of a gut level, kind of grinds my gears, I guess. But that was my knee-jerk reaction. But the more I think about it, you know, I guess it's private land. They've gone through the process as they're supposed to. It does seem like it would be a boon for the county from a tax revenue standpoint and from a job standpoint. I still can't wrap my head around how they make this work from a financial standpoint because, you know, it's such a huge task to run a ski resort, even for, you know, a seasonal operation like that. You got to have avalanche control and lifties and ski patrol and people, you know, working the ticket booth, maybe not ticket booth if it's all private, but you know, it's not a small task. And so for a relatively small group of people to be able to support that financially seems really challenging. Again, like I said, on some level, I like to think that the natural treasures we have in the state are accessible to as many people as possible. So, you know, from a sort of philosophical gut standpoint, that is troubling, I think. But it seems like, I mean, and maybe Brian, I don't know if you can address the legal arguments that the opponents are making, but it sounds like the zoning requests and everything that they checked the boxes as they were supposed to there.
Yeah. Well, what they're arguing is that, hey, they have a county general plan, they have zoning. And if you just, you know, rezone things willy nilly, it just kind of makes a mockery of this vision you've created for your community. That's their main objection. They've also raised some concerns about conflicts of interest among county council members. And then also they had to go to court to get this voter referendum put on the ballot. The county summarily rejected their petition. They went to court. The case was thrown out. The Supreme Court reinstated the case, and now it's going to trial. So we'll see. The thing is, it's like, well, what if this, the question I have is, well, what if you put this on the ballot and the voters of Morgan County reject the rezone? Well, they've already, Wasatch Peaks Ranch has already begun to develop and invested millions in, you know, installing infrastructure and all this stuff, but you haven't even built the ski area.
Yeah.
Does that mean what then, you know? That's another whole other question. You know.
And we don't often let the public vote on private property rights in the state. It's sort of a sacrosanct concept in the state, but putting it to a vote seems like a bad way to go. I guess if it doesn't work, then they've got a whole other problem on their hands. But it seems like in terms of impact to the community, having a small private resort is probably better than having a large sprawling public resort or more public resorts.
So, that's exactly how Ed Schultz framed that question. Was how you put it. But there is this sociological phenomenon here of just, you know, these having these really ultra wealthy people who kind of jet in for town for a month here or there, and then for the most part their 8,000 square foot homes are vacant up on that hillside. They're not really part of the community, but you know, they're not creating, you know, that many impacts. They're not putting kids in the schools, and the resort itself it's completely self-contained. They've established all these special districts that will provide all the utilities and everything, sewer, wastewater, water, roads, street lights, gutters, you name it. The homeowners themselves up there will be covering all those without putting any impact on the county services, for the most part. I mean, that's so it's kind of like a sociological question as opposed to as much as anything else.
Well, we need to let's go to break here, and we'll come back with a interesting story, a heartbreaking story about kids. Yes. Leaving mothers who have left the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So we've been talking with Brian Maffley and had commentary there from Robert Gerke as well. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. More following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Very interesting story, heartbreaking for these mothers. These are mothers who I think they have, to a woman, have left the Polygamous Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Their kids have been leaving. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's right. So it's this group of mothers who have left the FLDS, which is, as many people know, kind of an offshoot of the mainstream Mormon church that practices polygamy, and that is kind of based in this area in southern Utah and in northern Arizona that's called Short Creek. And yeah, so these mothers have left the church and they say that their children are being essentially lured back in. They allege that they have either been kidnapped or that the children have been kind of convinced to run away from home.
So the leader of the church, Warren Jeffs, he's been imprisoned in Texas, right? What's happened lately with him? The mothers say that there's a connection.
Right. So yeah, Warren Jeffs is in prison in Texas for sexually assaulting girls that he had married. I think he was convicted in 2006. They say that he, through his son, Helaman Jeffs, has been issuing revelations from his cell. And these revelations essentially call young members of the faith to come back. They use this term called translate, which essentially means like you die and you go to heaven. And so he put out this revelation calling for young people to come back and become pure in the faith, and that they'll have to die soon because the world is coming to an end, but that they'll gain salvation. And so these mothers are worried that their children are kind of listening to that call and returning back to the faith so that they can go to heaven.
What are the police saying? Can they do anything?
So these mothers say that they've all gone to police. There's 8 kids that we know that are missing. Some people think that there might be more than that, but there's 8 that we can track. And the mothers all say that they've gone to police and said, look, you know, my kids, this isn't a typical runaway case, essentially. You know, there's more going on here. And they say that the police just kind of brush off and that they say that there's nothing in their power that they can do.
So yeah, these are just heartbreaking stories from the point of view of these mothers. Maybe tell me about a couple of these mothers.
Yeah, I'll start with Lorraine Jessup. So she was part of the FLDS faith. She left in 2020 after her husband passed away, and she had left her kids with a sister wife there that she had trusted. It's kind of important to note that within the FLDS faith, your kids aren't really considered yours. They're considered part of the faith. They're considered the property of the church instead of the parents. And so it's kind of customary if a parent is leaving the faith that they leave their children behind. So she had left her kids with a sister wife and moved into Cedar City, nearby Cedar City. It's about 60 miles away from the community. And then in January, she actually got custody of her kids. And so she had her 3 kids come live with her. And then about a month later, she woke up. She noticed, you know, the house was really cold. She walked, you know, to her front door and it was open. And then she looked in her kids' bedrooms and all the beds were empty. So she believes her 3 kids were essentially lured away. They have older siblings that have remained in the FLDS faith. And she thinks that they've been in communication. She found, you know, some like survival supplies in her kids' rooms that she believes that the siblings had sent to them so they could get away, the walkie-talkies, bandages, knives, that kind of thing. And yeah, they just they've disappeared. She hasn't seen them for more than 70 days now. She hasn't heard from them, and she's really worried. I mean, these are heartbreaking stories to hear. And you know, while I'm at it, I might as well say Trent Nelson has been covering this community, our photographer, for 20 years. And you should take a look at the images of these mothers. I mean, they're just heartbroken, obviously.
In your story, Lorraine Jessup, she says this is child trafficking. This is kidnapping. That's what she's saying. I imagine the other mothers are agreeing with this. But again, they're saying the police are telling them that I guess not much they can do.
Right. Yeah. And they're calling on law enforcement to take this seriously, to see it for what it is, instead of just saying, oh, it's a runaway. The kid didn't want to be home, you know, throwing their hands up and saying they can't do anything. You know, she's saying, look, there's a different influence going on here. This isn't a traditional runaway case. And these mothers are asking for police to investigate.
Someone in your story, I can't remember who, speculated that Warren Jeffs, with his latest revelation, is responding to Samuel Bateman.
Yeah, this is an interesting time for the FLDS. It's a little complicated, but Samuel Bateman is this leader that's come up recently. He's in jail right now. But essentially this leader that said, that had been telling his followers that Warren Jeffs had died and that he was the new leader of the FLDS. And obviously, you know, Warren Jeffs has not died. He's in jail. But some people think that these revelations that he's sending out are kind of his, Warren Jeffs' way to kind of regain power, to kind of shut down Samuel Bateman and his followers, which is interesting. I mean, Bateman, I should note, you know, has been arrested for destroying evidence and then later in a separate case was charged with kidnapping. But he hasn't been charged with child abuse. So I think that's important to note. But yeah, there is this kind of warring between two leaders that kind of underplays all of this, too.
What is the, of course, this happened, in, you know, this, you talk to these women in Cedar City. I don't know if you know what the atmosphere is like in Colorado City and Hilldale at this point.
Yeah, I mean, so I was down there in the fall, and then, you know, the community has moved away from religion a lot, honestly. So there's not a ton of FLDS or even Bateman followers there to this day. I mean, there's maybe 50 followers of Bateman total, and estimates put FLDS followers at about 4,000, but they're not really living in that area so much anymore. You know, a lot of them, there's this great piece by Nate Carlisle from a few years ago called The Exodus of the FLDS. A lot of them have left to, you know, Cedar City or Beaver and other communities, because there's this whole other debate about housing and who owns some of the buildings down there, too. And but I mean, the community itself has become more secular. We reported on, you know, the high school getting its first football team, which is a really big deal. Warren Jeffs had banned sports and music outside of church hymns and, you know, the internet and all these things when he was, you know, living there and ruling there. And so the town itself is moving a lot more forward, I guess, becoming more modern, but there are still, you know, these little factions and these followers really throughout the state and the country.
Oh, it's interesting. So a lot of these folks have moved to Cedar and Beaver.
Yeah, and kind of spread out. Some are even in, you know, like North Dakota. There's a little group there. But yeah, I would say like Short Creek, which is Hilldale and Colorado City itself, is becoming a little less FLDS. Mark Eddington at the Tribune also did this great piece on this brewery down there, which, you know, wouldn't really happen if it was still very FLDS heavy. So the community is changing, but that doesn't mean that there isn't still a grip that, you know, the FLDS and Warren Jeff still has, which I think is obviously displayed by these mothers and, you know, their children that they're worried about.
Mm. Well, Courtney Tanner, thank you so much for telling us about this.
Yeah, thank you.
Robert Gerke, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, great reporting by Courtney. I mean, it's a really heartbreaking story, like you alluded to at the beginning. I think, you know, having gone down there 20 plus years ago to cover the community, And looking at it today, she touched on the changes that have occurred and how it's opened up to the outside world. The brewery is a good example. I mean, never would have happened in 2000 when I was reporting down there. But it's but there's still this. So on the surface, it looks like there's been this change, but there's still this long reach that these leaders have, that they can exercise this control over people, even from behind bars. And so, and she touched on, I think it's important to note that, like, the notion that parents don't actually have authority over their children, and that's not just something that's drilled into the parents, that's drilled into the kids, that their parents are not really their parents if they fall away from the church. And so yeah, it's certainly conceivable that that people like Warren Jeffs could have this kind of control, and you know, it means that we need to continue to have the support system there for the people who are either trying to get out of it or are vulnerable in the case of these kids. And so I'm glad that Courtney highlighted it. Hopefully there are state and federal resources there that can kind of at least try to, you know, locate these kids and make sure that they're safe and not being exploited. And if, you know, hopefully, you know, reunite these families in the way that they should be. You know, it's heartbreaking, as we said at the outset, and you know, something we'll have to keep an eye on.
Let's head toward another break here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll have more following this break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. Let's turn next to Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Jacob Scholl. Thanks for joining us, Jacob.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Jacob Scholl also reports for Utah Public Radio in partnership with Salt Lake Tribune. So this latest story of yours, Jacob, state audit alleges former Cache County prosecutors misused public resources. Tell us about this audit.
Yeah, so essentially this is an audit that came out, would have been late last week. Essentially, the audit started because there was a whistleblower complaint to the Utah State Auditor's Office. I should say that all these are allegations and, you know, have not been taken to court. There are no charges filed, you know, that sort of thing. So I'll preface that. Essentially, what this auditor's report indicated was that there were members of the Cache County Attorney's Office who were essentially using not only their position in the office, but also Cache County resources to essentially benefit themselves outside of work. And essentially, the crux of it is this. Cache County prosecutors in the past have signed contracts with, you know, cities, other counties, particularly nearby Rich County, which, of course, is a very rural county. That is where Bear Lake is, you know, that sort of thing. And those contracts are, you know, normally on the up and up. You know, you have, you know, whether it's city or county governments, you know, whatever entity is involved with these sort of things, those governments, those municipalities are approving these sorts of contracts. The crux of this audit was that in the past, Cache County Attorney's Office had a deal with Rich County to essentially prosecute their criminal matters. And this audit is alleging that in November of 2018, essentially in Rich County, they just cut out Cache County entirely. And instead of having a contract go through, you know, Cache County government, it was essentially put on the side. So at that point, the then elected Cache County attorney and a deputy were receiving money from Rich County to prosecute these cases. You know, there were some additional contracts from there, but that's really the crux of this entire thing.
Does this rise to level of a crime?
Well, I am not an attorney, so I'm not going to try and speculate on that. But I will say that when this audit came out, a lot of people in the Cache County government, by all assumption, took this very seriously. There were, in pretty short order, there were statements put out from not only the county government, but also the Cache County Attorney's Office, which I should also say that essentially the two prosecutors who were not particularly named in the report, though there was a timeline included in the report of who was the Cache County attorney, depending on the time frame. The two attorneys who are referred to here, who are essentially said could be accused of wrongdoing, are no longer with the Cache County Attorney's Office. So I digress. Let's see. When this came out, the county attorney's office and the county itself put out pretty strong statements saying, they cooperated with investigations. They are happy to assist in anything going forward. You know, they're reviewing employment records to make sure that there aren't other county employees who have these kind of side contracts. I bring all this up to say that in the midst of all this, another thing that they included in those reports was, or in these press statements, was a request to the Utah Attorney General's office to investigate and potentially prosecute this kind of thing. So, again, I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to speculate whether or not laws were broken, but at the same time, these sorts of allegations are serious enough to where the county has already reached out to the Utah Attorney General's office to potentially investigate.
In the meantime, you talked to James Swink, who's a former Cache County attorney. What is he saying?
Yeah, so like I said, he wasn't particularly mentioned in the report, but just given my background knowledge of Cache County, I knew that for most of this time, James Swink was the elected county attorney. I believe he served in the office for about 13 years. I reached out to him and, essentially said, hey, this audit is about the office you used to lead. What do you think about that? And he really said that, essentially there's two sides to every story. Let's see if I can get this. I was talking with him and essentially he said the audit does not include available facts that would refute these allegations. It was pretty clear from the auditor's report that Swink and the other former prosecutor definitely talked with the state auditor's office. He said it pretty clearly that he doesn't believe he did anything wrong. He doesn't believe there's any criminal conduct. And like you said, he believes there's two sides to every story. Obviously there is. He is pretty confident in that.
Well, interesting. We'll keep an eye on this. I'm sure you'll keep an eye on this for the Tribune. You can find that reporting at sltrib.com. Jacob, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Robert Gerke, what do you think about this?
Not a ton to say, I guess. It's baffling to me when internal controls break down like this, and it takes an audit to reveal this. The county seemed to think, or seemed to not even realize that this was going on right under their noses, and it kind of calls into question the diligence of the commission. I think that completely missed this. It's good that we have these auditors come in behind and looking for this sort of impropriety, and good that there's going to be presumably an investigation, and we'll see how that plays out.
Well, let's turn to our underplayed stories of the week here. Let me start with Brian Maffley. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, thanks. I was really saddened to hear yesterday about the passing of Jeremy Nobis, a brilliant skier who was a standout on the U.S. ski team back in the early 90s, competing in Lillehammer. You know, he's a slalom racer, but where he really made a splash was being a pioneer in free skiing. He really just completely blew out the boundaries of what people thought of as skiing, to star in a lot of really great ski movies by Teton Gravity Research and Matchsticks and things like that. Anyway, he, according to our reporting by Julie Jagg, he died in a jail in Cedar City at the age of 52 this week, where he was awaiting, you know, sentencing on his, you know, his fifth or whatever DUI conviction. I guess his life, you know, went in a bad direction in recent years. So anyway, it's a sad story here. I was, but I encourage people to read it. Julie wrote the story. It's in today's paper.
SLTrib.com is where you can find that. Thanks, Brian. Yeah. Turn next to Courtney Tanner. What's your underplayed story of the week?
I'd love to highlight a story by Peyton Harkins, who looked at the marathon route, the Salt Lake City marathon route, and found seven pretty cool things to see. I don't want to spoil any of them, but go take a look at that. It's a fun story.
Oh, spoil it, Courtney. Let's give us an example.
My favorite is the Fourth Avenue well. I think that's kind of cool. I just think it's interesting. I didn't know it was there. I think that's fascinating.
It's great. Yeah, you don't have to be on the marathon to go along the route. That's great. So sltrib.com to find that story as well. Jacob Scholl, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, so it's a story that came out this morning. It's very concerning. It's a report from Brian Schott just about the sovereign citizen movement inside of Utah. Brian is reporting that recently the Davis County Republican Party elected three members who had recently essentially were using sovereign citizen symbols in a legal document. It just kind of goes in depth with, the background of not only what sovereign citizens are, but, you know, some of their ideology. And it's, you know, it's definitely noteworthy and concerning that, people who have these thoughts that they are immune from any government interference that they, that they don't want to deal with are, you know, also people being elected into leadership roles within political parties. So definitely check that out.
Very interesting. Yes, sltrib.com to find that story. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Oh, Jacob took mine. So I'm gonna point to one that the New York Times did, actually, that John Curtis, Representative John Curtis, and seven other members of Congress sold shares in banks during the Silicon Valley bank collapse, and there, you know, this raises questions about insider trading, insider knowledge. Curtis's office didn't respond, but the story is available. It's by the New York Times, but it's available at sltrib.com if anybody wants to check it out.
Mine, I'm going to highlight something from the Great Salt Lake Collaborative. Just read this. They've created an interactive website to help Utahns understand the critical role of Great Salt Lake and its wetlands in the ecosystem crucial to 10 million birds. So it's called Water for Wildlife, Dire Consequences for a Shrinking Great Salt Lake. It uses images, audio, video, and text to answer your questions. So you can get that link at the story at sltrib.com. And it's the byline includes two UPR reporters, Amy Van Tietenhove and Ellis Julin, along with our Adam Dastrup. So find that at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, we have just a couple of minutes here. I want to have you talk about one of your two pieces here this week about ranked choice voting. Tell us briefly about ranked choice voting.
Yeah, I was thinking about using this one as my underplayed. So the notion behind ranked choice voting is instead of just voting for one candidate, sometimes it feels like it's the lesser of two evils or the least offensive choice. You get to rank the candidates, as many candidates as file to run. You rank them in the order that you prefer. And then if your first choice ends up at the bottom, you know, they get the fewest votes, then your vote rolls to the second choice or the third choice and so on and so forth until one of the candidates has a majority. And it sounds kind of confusing. We have a little tutorial video on at sltrib.com. But cities have the options to use this year. North Logan had signed up for it. They backed out. There's Salt Lake, Mill Creek, a handful of cities, a Heber Vineyard, have all signed up to do it. Cities have until May 1st to choose this. And the notion behind it is, you know, it changes the way people campaign, because instead of trying to, you know, denigrate the opponent, run them down, scorched earth kind of political tactics, you have to solicit people to be, if not their first choice, their second choice, third choice. And it focuses the campaign season on, you know, a debate of ideas rather than, you know, a personality feud. And so cities that have tried it have really liked it. And it has some potential, I think, particularly in these municipal races, to elevate the discourse. So if there's still time, I guess, if your city's not one of them that's doing it, there might still be time to convince your city council to do it. If not, you can look 2 years down the road and try it then.
And you can find Robert's piece at sltrib.com. So we've reached the end of our program. We thank Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley for joining us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Thanks. Reporter Courtney Tanner, thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Statewatch reporter and UPR reporter Jacob Scholl, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Salt Lake Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
You too. And we thank everyone for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams, and we'll talk with you next week on Behind the Headlines. Mm-hmm.